This is Earth Files, the award-winning news site with the latest updates in science, environment, and real X-Files. Podcasting in-depth reports beyond the 6 o'clock news by Emmy Award-winning journalist Linda Moulton Howe.
Hi, everyone here and around the world. This week, Monday, April 8th, as you all know, it started with the excitement about the total solar eclipse that darkened the sun to a black circle inside a bright ring in at least 13 states, like this in Colebrook, New Hampshire, by Scott Eisen, and beyond to Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Missouri, Illinois, Kentucky, Indiana, Ohio, New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, and Pennsylvania, where my daughter Laura and granddaughter Hannah took cell phone images like this beautiful one in the cloudy sky as the moon passed directly between the sun and the earth, completely blocking the sun's light and casting a shadow down on a small area of earth. In this case, it was in Philadelphia. This is the third total solar eclipse that I have seen, and this one was through TV and cell phones. The total eclipse I saw before now was in Idaho on August 21st of 2017 with this diamond ring flare. And before that, I saw my first total solar eclipse in Reims, France on August 11th, 1999. There, I was in a huge open field, and when the moon's greenish-black shadow began to move across the tall grass, I started running with the shadow and yelling in raw joy at the overwhelming energy of the universe around me. That total solar eclipse was the last one of the 20th century in Europe. Also from the 20th century, here is one of the most important historic headlines that we all should celebrate. It's the Roswell Daily Record's July 8, 1947 front page. Quote, Roswell Army Airfield captures flying saucer on ranch in Roswell region. Close quote. That headline has been one of the only true news reports about UFOs in the past half century. And this summer on July 8, 2024, will be the 77th anniversary of that honest headline. But the truth was soon followed up by this cover-up lie that same day back on July 8, 1947, when the Roswell Daily Record had a sister news office, the Roswell Dispatch, that posted this follow-up headline, quote, Army debunks Roswell flying disc as world simmers with excitement. Officers say disc is weather balloon, close quote. The U.S. government, ever since then, has had strict policies of denial and cover-up about UFO advanced technologies. But there have also been whistleblowers from military, aerospace, and intelligence operations over the past 77 years since World War II, who have whispered to some of us truth hunters that advanced extraterrestrial and artificial intelligences are operating UFO craft that have been seen and reported for decades all over this world. This illustration from March 20th, 1950 is by airline pilot Captain Jack Adams flying over Stuttgart, Arkansas with First Officer G.W. Anderson in a DC-3 commercial jetliner. Captain Adams sketched this, quote, flying disc that crossed the sky at an estimated 1,000 miles an hour in 1950. The round craft seemed to have windows on its outer rim and to have a blue light on top which blinked rapidly, close quote. Four decades later, on January 23, 1983, the Welsh UK Sunday Express headlined, quote, strange debris out of the sky, close quote. The 1983 UK newspaper story had similarities to the American July 1947 UFO crash between Roswell and Corona, New Mexico. And that was where rancher Mac Brazel, walking in his cow pasture, found lots of weird, shiny silver foil, hard, thin rods covered with strange orchid-colored symbols, and silver metal pieces that would spring back to the original shape if bent or twisted. An astonishing sight greeted farmer Irwell Evans as he trudged across his fields to tend his newly born lambs. Hundreds of pieces of honeycomb metal sheets were strewn over an area the size of 3 football pitches, which is the size of a football field. Huge, twisted alloy plates, painted green on one side and gray on the other, lay in pieces everywhere. And in a nearby copse of trees, the top branches had been sheared off. Mr. Evans telephoned the police, and soon his farm at Clonilla, near Aberystwyth in Wales, was like a film set from a spy thriller. Police took away some large fragments of metal for analysis. A team of uniformed Royal Air Force men with plainclothes officers combed the land and nearby woods, using flashlights as darkness began to fall, and found oddly shaped metal pieces like this, as light as air, close quote. But which date? Farmer Irwell Evans knew it was in the first week of January 1983. He daily checked his animals late at night or early morning, and everything had been fine until maybe January 2nd or 3rd. And then Mr. Evans was shocked to find all the strange dark and silver metal pieces spread all over the ground and the grove of trees on his property that had all been cut off at the same height in a swath about 25 feet in diameter, assumed to be the diameter of the mystery UFO craft that came down there. All of this happened near the Welsh villages of Clonilla and Aberystwyth on the St. George's Channel of Wales, only 6 miles apart and about 125 miles west of the large city of Birmingham, England. The farmer said there was no debris anywhere the night before he found hundreds of pieces of honeycomb metal foil strewn over an area the size of a football field. No one in the close-knit Welsh community heard a plane that night. Nothing unusual showed up on Royal Air Force radar scanners. Mr. Evans, the farmer, who was 29 years old then, runs his 260 acres single-handed. He said, quote, "Whatever tumbled from the sky broke up on impact. It must have been a fair size. Wreckage was scattered across 4 fields. Had it hit a building, there's no doubt the devastation could have been terrific. It must have come down the night before I found it, for the area was clear in the afternoon when I checked the flock, yet I heard nothing at all unusual. Although the pieces themselves were extremely light, they must have fallen with some force to sever branches off trees. It is all very disturbing," close quote. Mr. Amir Hughes, secretary of the Cardiganshire Farmers Union, said, quote, "I've asked the Ministry of Defense for an explanation, but so far have had no reply. The RAF say they had no aircraft out at the time that this debris must have landed, nor any maneuvers. Not only that, their radar scanners picked up nothing unusual. Could it be part of a large weather balloon? No, say police, too much metal. Could it be part of a downed satellite? Unlikely. Any remains would be charred. We have no explanation. It's baffling," close quote. One documentary and one book have been produced about this Welsh UFO mystery. First, in 2008, Reality Films in the United States produced this documentary called Europe's Roswell, UFO Crash in Aberystwyth, from Mark Olley's Untold Tales, File 1.
That documentary was distributed on Amazon Prime. But today, in 2024, that documentary is now on YouTube at a website called Drake, Michigan, where Europe's Roswell and many other Mark Olley productions can be seen. Mark Olley is author of 9 books, including this new 2024 update of Europe's Roswell, 40 Years Since Impact, now available on Amazon, published by Philip Mantle, owner of Flying Disc Press in West Yorkshire, England. Mark Olley is also an archaeologist who is a visiting lecturer at the Wilmslow Guild and the University of Chester. He also runs a DVD production and props company called MythCo and appears in the History Channel's Ancient Aliens. Mark Olley is a good friend of Gary Rowe, who runs a civilian UFO group in North Wales and was the original investigator of the January 1983 silent explosion in Planilla near Aberystwyth. It was Gary Rowe who first heard in early January 1983 that a grove of trees in Planilla had been cut straight across by something 25 feet in diameter, and he went to investigate. Gary found some metal pieces as big as 6 feet by 6 feet. Later, laboratory tests confirmed there was a large amount of the element called lanthanum in the large metal sheets that were also completely covered with embedded patterns of 6-sided hexagons.
Whatever it was, its maximum width was about 25 feet. Well, that's too big for a drone, and it's too small for an aircraft.
Yeah, why at night wouldn't people have heard the sound of this kind of damage happening and run out of their houses and seen what was happening?
Yeah, exactly. And there was no bangs, no flashes, no boom, no sound at all. So you've got a fairly major impact. As you say, you should have created at least some noise, you know, and you've got all this metal being scattered all over the place.
What was it about these pieces that impressed you as an archaeologist that you would want to do continual research?
Well, as soon as you look at them, they are featured in the book. I mean, the book's a bit of a show and tell, so you get to see them. And as soon as you look at them, there's something not right with them straight away. As soon as you actually handle them and look at them and the weight of them, the colour of them, I've never seen anything like it in my life. So I was impressed really from the get-go. There was about 6 fragments that they managed to recover. 4 of them are quite obviously sheet metal of some kind, and 2 of them were like tin foil filled with honeycomb. So they were literally honeycomb tin foil. That just didn't weigh anything, but it was very, very difficult to squash. So that was odd because it was very strong, and we still to this day don't know what that is because that hasn't been analysed. But out of the 4 pieces of metal, 1 piece was very, very thin, and it was grey on one side and green on the other side. And when you tried to bend it or crease it or snap it, it just sprung back. You couldn't change the shape of it, and it really didn't weigh anything. And then the other pieces, they're a bit more like eggshell, grey on one side, but they're coated with literally thousands of hexagons all over the top surface of it. They're sort of convex. Well, you could put the biggest piece, say 30 centimetres by 20 centimetres, you could put it on the floor and stamp on it, and it wouldn't give. It would just stay rigid in the same shape, even though it was so thin. Again, it didn't weigh anything, but the metal inside it looked like a sort of crusty de-aluminium material. It was just extraordinarily odd. You couldn't drill it, you couldn't cut it, you couldn't saw it. The only way you could get pieces off it was to grab it with a pair of pliers and sort of wiggle it and snap it at very slow speed. So it was almost like the metal was fighting back. Just incredibly strong, incredibly light material. But we have done analysis last year, so we know what it is now.
What?
Years ago, we thought it was duralumin. British Aerospace had a look at it, and they said, oh, it looks like duralumin. So we sent 1 sample off to a laboratory in Australia, and another sample went to a laboratory in America. The one in Australia came back and said it's aluminium foam, which is a type of reactive aluminium that goes hard at room temperature. They thought it might be man-made, but the one that went to America, that came back and they sent a substance called lanthium or lanthanum. It's everywhere. It's in everything. It's in meteorites and galaxies and all over planet Earth. But it's incredibly difficult to get out of the ground to refine it. Costs thousands and thousands of dollars to do it. This was aluminium foam. It's a type of reactive metal. The lab that we used in America was MUFON. They may comment on it. They were the better ones at testing it, and they got the better material as well.
I ask about the UK, thinking that maybe you had shown these pieces once you got reports from MUFON and others, that you might have shown them to a scientist, like a metallurgist or somebody who works with ion microprobes.
Yes, we did. We went off to people in the military that are involved with things like tornado aircraft. None of them would comment on the record.
And when they wouldn't comment, what words did they say to you?
Most of it was no comment. We can't say anything. We don't know. We've never heard of lanthium. We've never heard of the use of lanthium or lanthanum. Yes, we know about aluminium foam, but we weren't using it at that point in time. That's all the feedback we got back. The analysis came from MUFON of Missouri Laboratory. Strange stuff.
Yeah. Has MUFON reported any of this?
It was done in reasonable secrecy because the book wasn't out. They could comment on it now because it's in print.
Tell me, for everyone to hear, about how to get the book that has the photographs and has the scientific analysis in it.
Okay, well, it's got everything, absolutely everything we know, photographs, diagrams, analysis. The book's called Europe's Roswell, 40 Years Since Impact, and it's available through Amazon. It's worth mentioning, some of these pieces of metal were 2 meters square, 6 foot square. That's more lanthium than mankind has ever mined. And that's just one sheet, one piece of fragment. And this stuff's covering like a football field.
Did anybody back in the 1983 time period go up in a helicopter or a fixed wing and take photographs looking down on the tree damage from the UFO?
No, they didn't. It's a real shame. No photographs at all, as far as I know, exist of the crash site at the time. And it would have been difficult to do that because of how quickly they removed the woodland. They were really on that within a matter of weeks.
Did you have any proof about whether it was an American military, American intelligence, or UK military or UK intelligence team that came in and took out all of those trees?
The only proof we have is that the eyewitness, Erwell, said that what he was seeing was British. So you have British police, British Air Force people, and then these guys in the civilian outfits. They were all British with British accents. So I don't think there was any Americans involved in that cleanup operation. But that doesn't rule out one of the analysis that came back from Australia. They felt that the grey substance used on their sample, they felt that that resembled a type of American glue. But then the problem we had was when the analysis came back from the American laboratory, they didn't find that. So that was contradictory. We've published it as is, but that's the only American connection we've got, is this type of glue, which could be a mistake by the Australian lab.
But it also could be an act of deception on the part of the United States intelligence operations that were actively involved in investigating and trying to nail down everything they could about what happened in England. And our government has done that all over the world.
Well, there's definitely smoke and mirrors involved. There's no doubt about that, because the original newspaper report included information that the eyewitness didn't remember, which downplayed the original crash. There was something wrong with that. Then this American glue crept in, which was from the Australian lab, and I read it and I felt like they'd been got at. Then when the DVD came out, that was an American company that put that out, but it just died on its feet. So all down the line, it just looks like it's been, you know, killed off at the American level. The publisher has samples, additional samples. I've got one additional sample. Obviously, it's a finite resource. We don't have tons of it. We've only got the bits that Gary recovered. And he really is possessive. He's protected them for 40 years. So with the bits we've got, we've probably got another shot at an analysis. But it's finding somebody who'll go on record. In America, what they tend to do is they've got plausible deniability. Over here, the policy is complete silence. This isn't in the book, okay? Here's some new information for you. We pursued some freedom of information requests over here in the UK. We did the usual. We did all three Air Force bases, the police, military MOD files, and then we finished up at the Central Record Office in Kew, and they have the archives, so they have a lot of the past material there. And we got a very interesting reply from them, and the reply, basically the gist of it, said, we are not allowed to release information on this incident because it still contains the details, the names and what have you of people that were involved, and therefore it's covered by data protection. At which point, me and the publisher, Philip, were laughing like nobody's business, because at the end of the day, what they've just done there is they've said, yes, there was an incident, there has been a crash, we know that and we've got records of it, and number two, the people that were reported as involved in the cleanup operation, clearly they also exist and are probably still alive today. So it was the first actual official confirmation we'd got from MOD records that this happened. So it definitely happened. So we've definitely got the debris, we've definitely got the analysis, and now we've got confirmation in the last couple of months that it definitely happened.
You know, I would be very interested if Ian and Eric have the ability to do like a quick poll of all of you here tonight about how many ever heard of this 1983 sort of like Roswell case before tonight. It amazes me how much can be buried under history. And then we begin to understand that certain dates, certain locations, certain places seem to have more cross meetings of different types of craft. And it is fascinating that here we are at the 2024 spring. And when I ended up being able to talk with Mark Ollie, and we were comparing notes, and how much is not known out beyond a very certain small group of people about what you would have thought would have been known to the entire Welsh village and along that coastline. How could it have been so silent that nobody knew? And these are the kinds of mysteries that I love to investigate and bring to the Earth Files YouTube channel to share with you and see what you have experienced, what you might know. And Ian, if it is possible to do some sort of a quick sampling of how many people actually knew some of this information before tonight, I would be interested. And welcome, Ian, to coming into our interface with our audience.
Thank you, Linda. That was a fascinating report. And I actually was with Mark Ollie last Thursday evening when he gave a brilliant talk to the Birmingham UFO group. And you know, it was well received, and I recommend everyone to check out his books, and particularly his book on the European Roswell,
yes,
available on Amazon and all good bookstores.
But the question remains, Ian, how many people did not know about this? That is a fascinating question.
We're running the poll at the moment, right now in the chat. Eric and I have got that up, and it's showing currently no, 80%.
Are saying that
so
they didn't know.
To show.
Yeah.
That's right. And there are also correlations as well to another Welsh case, which is a little bit more well-known, the Pentic case. And I think you covered that one, where it seems a UFO was actually shot down, but there were
yes.
teams that arrived to clear up afterwards and silence witnesses.
Well, another thing that intrigues me, and I'd be very interested to know of our audience, how many have heard this, there have been allusions and sometimes straightforward statements over the last 40-some years for me of doing interviews with so many people on so many aspects of UFO encounters. And every once in a while, not very many, there have been references to something, structure or prints of six-sided, as if the hexagonal geometry played some role. And I wonder how many people listening tonight who may have technical backgrounds, or if there are people from aerospace who might have an insight about this whole issue of huge sheets, as Mark was describing. There weren't many, but there were a few that would be 6 feet by 6 feet, and they would be made with the embedded six-sided hexagonal pattern throughout, of which we saw three. We saw the bluish one, the grayish one, and the brown one. So there were at least those three different colors. And it isn't very common to, I would say, the general human experience to see metal that was completely imprinted as those were, in that case, with the six-sided geometries. And that issue of honeycombs and six-sided in the number has come up every once in a while, and I wonder if they're related, having to do with structure and technology.
Well, yeah, the hexagonal and honeycomb structures do feature as well with ET experiences. And we've got Lee XID in the chat this evening, who says, honeycomb, most structurally sound of economic for manufacturing and strength.
Yeah, and those are the same comments that I put in tonight's program, having to do with what would be the characteristics possibly of the foam aluminum, and that it gives a strength and it gives a compression ability that is much more intense.
One of the comments made this time, and when we were talking about the bismuth magnesium, is that perhaps this material is made in a different environment to us on Earth and is somehow more susceptible to damage when it comes to Earth, or has different properties which are exploited in the damage that they sustain when something happens and goes wrong, or however they end up splitting into a billion parts.
I don't know the answer to the details, but I certainly can say that it has been people in aerospace and physics who have given me probably the best insights and the most information, and that it has to do with, we know that there are advanced technologies that are being used by other intelligences who come from other places in the Milky Way galaxy and beyond. That's a fact. I'm just going to lay it out like that. From my point of view, that's a fact. But then everything comes to a screeching halt when it comes to any of us understanding the truth of all the details and how much can be done other dimensionally by advanced intelligences that can take something out of this dimension into another and back and completely make structural and at the subatomic level materials that are beyond our understanding or comprehension, because as you were pointing out, they are able to do structure and technology and create outside of just what we know as the Earth, Moon, Mars environment. And how exciting it would be to be exposed to that kind of engineering and the constant references to being able to move point to point, like the Alcubierre warp drive, and manipulating not only time, but all kinds of factors in a huge space like a galaxy, in which you are able to jump, not travel in a Euclidean line. You can jump to different places. And to me, this is the exciting part of all of it, is if we would just get past this strange, whimsical sentence that we're alone in the universe, and try to open up to the Earth and everybody, everything that is known about what is going on in the universe and the craft that I know that we have, maybe we would stop wars.
Yeah, certainly hope so. Tarantina from Argentina says, Jesse Marcel's son told exactly the same about a piece of metal of Roswell crushed his father brought home that night. And Tom the Man TV as well references the memory metal that seems to be a similar type of properties of that found in Wales.
Right. The memory metal are the ones that people have said they've tried to jump on or compress, or they've been able to get them in a lab and fold them over, and psh, they go right back to wherever they were originally.
Staying on the subject of the crash, 1111 says, what other countries have had a Roswell incident besides England? I know we've had a few reports from Brazil as well, but they want to know what other countries had a similar incident.
Well, I think that they have been all over all the continents everywhere. It's a question of proof and all of the physical data, but it is, if you started with all of the abduction cases that Dr. Leo Sprinkle had at the University of Wyoming when I started producing A Strange Harvest, that John Mack, who I was able to talk with about many abduction cases, and where do the abduction cases always lead to? They always lead to going to a craft, to someplace, and often people are exposed to what they consider to be like magic in technology. And that is what I think goes on around the whole planet and has. So to say how many countries would have which experiences and how many at any given measurement of time, it's where do you want to start counting on the clock? Where extraterrestrial biological entities with a lot of artificial intelligent beings like cyborgs or robots, when do they actually start having an impact on the geophysical nature of our planet, genetically manipulating DNA and already evolving primates, that document I was shown at Kirtland, and that the big picture that would be wonderful to understand is how long has Earth been the subject of investigations, explorations, and how many places? I mean, I think certainly every continent, and then you break down, there are places that have more UFO experiences and abduction experiences, but essentially it's global. It's Arctic, it's Antarctic, it's islands, it's water, it's inside of mountains, it's down below the depths of the Earth, the whole planet. And that would also include the Moon and Mars and beyond.
Okay, Linda, we've got Tom the Man TV says, he's talking about the ancient, seeing alien writing, but for some reason he can't remember it. Now, that links with another question he has about recovering memories via hypnosis. He says that he did see some alien writing, but he says, I swear I'm not making this up, but when I try to remember, I either get a headache or it's a bit foggy, almost as though there's some mind manipulation control still going on that's stopping him from remembering. However, he does feel that when he looks at the writing, it reads, you are a friend, as though he recognises it. Now, that goes back to perhaps your experience and writing about Jim Sparks and seeing symbols that actually translate into whole sentences or whatever.
Right. And he was being taught that by what I consider to be the progenitor greys, meaning They are biological, working with tremendous numbers of what we would call AI today, and that there are different layers of the progenitor grays. The one that wasn't specifically Jim Sparks' experience, but it has been other people. And that has been a tall 7 to 8 foot, very thin, huge head being. And it seems to be the one that is overseeing, overriding all the experiments that are being done by other grays. Whitley Strieber has a very interesting and complex view of the grays as well. And the all of it heads, from my point of view, to a big question that I have been trying to get more answers in the past year or two. Is if over 278 million years, to pick a number I have that have been has been given to me, for experiments and conflict between competing extraterrestrial civilizations in this solar system, including Earth, then what are the relationships of those non-humans to each other? Because we all have questions from an Earth point of view, looking up and out. What is it that all of these competing extraterrestrials have wanted in their experimentation of Earth and our solar system? And that's where you get into these difficult questions about the shape-shifting. And why is it that there have been these reports, Jim Mars and I had several that we would compare, where humans, whether it was a jungle or a desert or wherever it was, that whatever the non-humans were up to in terms of their agenda, they had the ability to shape-shift into the environment around them. And if you can shape-shift into an environment and you can be a desert or ice or water or whatever it is, why is that necessary? And it is a question of a presentation I'm going to be doing at Contact in the Desert. And that has to do with why do the non-humans use deception? If everything were straightforward, if everything was supportive, if everything involved goals that met in the same place, which would be supporting the evolution of life, encouraging the development of beings with consciousness about the universe that would include agape love and the ability to work with other beings, even if they didn't look like you, that something would have a positive evolutionary feel to it. And that's why I think that the whole issue of what kind of drama are we in? Because nothing is clear, and it always has had this feeling that I used in several lecture titles long ago. It's like we're in a hall of mirrors with a quicksand floor. And why should interaction with other intelligences have any feelings of ominous or confusion? That's always puzzled me. And that relates clearly to the other huge, huge question. Are we in a holographic universe? Because it was made specifically to train and teach souls that recycle to stay away from the dark and always go for the thought that dwells in the light. And eventually that may be the answer to this universe, because when you go back to Michael Talbot's book, all the way back to the end of the 80s, early 90s. And it's called The Holographic Universe. And he told Bud Hopkins, who told me, that the title, the information, everything was downloaded to him from extraterrestrials. And here we are now at 2024 with physicists, astrophysicists, and others who continue to put out pieces that we might be in a holographic universe. Well, how complex is it in this universe if there are multiple civilizations that don't even share the same goals and that end up manipulating genetic manipulation of each other? These are, to me, these are the big questions that I would love to know the answers to.
That's absolutely right. And it always seems so confusing that there are these competing races. Some ETs are wanting to share information and give information, yet others seem to want to cover it up and stop people from talking about it or investigating it any further. And you just mentioned your talk coming up at the upcoming Contact in the Desert. And I just want to tell everyone in our audience, I'm going to be posting the link in the chat and in the description below the video tonight about your upcoming talks at Contact in the Desert. You're not doing just that one. You've got several talks, I think, lined up, as well as panel appearances as well.
Right. Yeah, I think I'm doing three sort of big subjects, and then there will be the panels and the handshakes and hopefully agape hugs, although that is becoming even threatened because the diseases don't seem to be dying down. It's like that if you go to a conference and you actually are exchanging handshakes and hugs, you end up getting something, even if it's called unidentified influenza. Are you there?
That's right. And also, there's long chats outside at Contact in the Desert under the stars into the night.
And that is one of the most fun things that I always associate contact with. And I remember there was one particular conference where somebody had brought really good night vision glasses. And there was a group of us, and we stayed out on a side field of a hotel until 4 o'clock in the morning. And I remember I had to get up at 8 in order to get ready to do a presentation, but it didn't matter because what I still remember to this day was we were genuinely puzzled by how many things were moving in these really good night vision glasses, meaning what were they? There were so many different speeds, and it was out of that one experience that I thought, wow, you know, if you really had good night vision and infrared, and you set up and you had good cameras that could operate, there is so much going on in the skies that we don't see with our normal retina that it could evolve into a fascinating study that somebody might even publish. Would be.
Well, down at Giant Rock, which is just down the road from Contact at Landers, they have at Contact, they run the expeditions out there with night vision. And I was there in 2016, I think it was, and we recorded several unknowns that we were able to view. And it was fascinating to see them in real time.
But let's get past all of this cat and mouse stuff. I mean, here we are, 2024, working our way to the 2030, the scary number of what's supposed to have happened to the Earth between 2020 and 2030. Well, why can't everything be changed over to, all right, let's get introduced to real extraterrestrials that are advanced, that they can help us, that we don't have to be afraid of what is going to happen for the remainder of this decade and ongoing, and that Earth doesn't have to be worrying about some horrible future because we do have extraterrestrial allies. Why can't this decade convert into that instead of all of the war and doom? Because I think you sort of get what you concentrate on. And right now on Earth, it feels like every population everywhere is afraid, angry, attacking, or in war. How do we change that? And why can't we be introduced to non-humans who might help us all change to the good, to the positive?
Linda, we've got the results in of the poll. We had a poll completed, 350 votes, of which the answer, have you heard about Europe's Roswell before tonight? The answer, no, was 78%, and yes was 21%.
Yeah, that definitely matches what I would have expected, because I do think that the photographs of the hexagonal and all of those pieces, that if we had been introduced to that, let's say 10 or 20 years ago, it would have stuck. And it is fascinating that something that seems to me so physical, the hexagonal imprinted plates, for example, and that there have been efforts to find out what they are made of. And I'm aware of what a challenge sometimes, depending upon what you're dealing with and what labs have available, that I think, I know people have said to me, well, just go to a lab and find out what it's made of. But it isn't quite that simple. And what the evolutionary path that the guys in England, Philip Mantle and Mark Olley and their crew there, everybody there, and John Rowe and all of them, they have really worked hard trying to understand. But it for anybody who is tonight in the Earth Files YouTube channel audience, who might be a scientist, who might have a laboratory or has facilities, this is something that could help some of us who do have materials off and on that we would like to learn more about. And it isn't simple. It isn't like you dial up a number and you get an answer. It takes work and it takes a lot of time. But why would it be anything but something to be excited about and trying to do if any or all of us could work positively toward any kind of unusual material that anybody listening has, that they received from a non-human and they knew it was a non-human or whatever the circumstance? Getting laboratory tests are fascinating, and they often lead to other discoveries. So this is a piece that of the population, and we are getting close to breaking through 270,000 subscribers. I hope if those of you here tonight who have not subscribed, you will. We like to do those celebrations when we break through certain numbers, and we're getting close to that kind of celebration. And it would be wonderful if we really had almost like a network that would grow out of Earth Files, how to test certain materials and know that you were in a world in which it was responsible science and can be reported. And that's something every one of us could keep working toward. Okay, Ian.
Linda, a question from Ram says, Linda, do you have any dreams lately that relate to your work?
I have not been dreaming. I go through stages where I don't dream at all and would remember if I did. And then I think that for the most of my life, that when I have a dream and it stays vivid, vivid dreams have helped me come up with titles and sequences for things I've been working on in television or production. And I almost depend upon those dreams. It isn't anything that I do to bring them. It's that dreams somehow have always been woven into the work that I've always done. So that is a very positive. But occasionally, and it certainly was happening in the 2019, I will have something like what people in the abduction syndrome, where they say they'll have a vivid dream. I've waked up where I've seen fire coming out of a tree and out of the top of a building. And sometimes it brings me right out of bed to consciousness. It's so vivid, if it's that kind of a dream. And then is always the puzzle, because usually nothing that literal happens for real. A tree doesn't catch fire in your yard or a building with fire. But to me, when I have a vivid dream and it hangs around me, like you get up and some dreams you literally turn on a light and walk around, that they have that impact. those are the dreams that seem to me that my soul and my intuition are picking up on something that I need to be aware of, alarmed by, warned by. And that's how I have looked at them. When you move over into the abduction category, it seems to me that I have felt with many people that I have interviewed deeply, like for hours, and have listened to all of the details, that you begin to feel that with the abductees, vivid dreams that hang around, that they're there, that the parts of them don't leave a room immediately. It's communication. It's definitely communication through metaphors, physical metaphors, other things. But the question always is, why? If telepathy is clear, then why is it ever necessary to come through in the dream stage? And anybody tonight who's listening who may be a professional in any of these areas, if you have any other insights, let me know, and I'll report it in an upcoming Earth Files. But I think if you took it all, and Ian, I think I would like to ask you if you agree, that we are conscious beings in a conscious universe. And that's an important distinction. It is not an unconscious universe, it's conscious. And that everything with consciousness in this universe is interacting. And therefore, it makes sense to me that depending upon what your interaction with matter is, with energy is, with light is, with dark is, you're going to have self-producing projections. That the soul, I think, has a lot to do with trying to help lives. And that it's complex. But if you listen to your inner words and you pay attention to dreams and not let them scare you, but teach you, make you more aware, then maybe it's all positive in the long run. Go ahead, Ian.
Yeah, the dreams are a fascinating part, and I'm still meeting up with lots of people who have ET experiences, and they always talk about their vivid dreams, or right. The dreams were so vivid, they feel there was more to it than a dream. I have to move on to our super chats to acknowledge our super chats from our generous audience tonight. And we have an audience tonight, Linda, that's from not only all over the United States, Canada, United Kingdom, Ireland, Bahamas, Argentina, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Chile, and probably many other places that I haven't mentioned tonight.
Oh, thank you. I love the whole feeling that we come together on Wednesday nights as a world body. As a not, I am in this side of a line and you're in that side of a line, but that we are in an earth with a feeling that if we could blur all of the lines and we could just agape love each other as fellow beings, what a transformation we might see on this dear planet.
Absolutely, and we're all connected underneath the oceans, and we're all connected as one, and we offer a safe space here at Earth Files for people to come and bring their stories and share their experiences and share their opinions. So here we go for the super chats this evening. We've got Cat Chaser, Gloria Canales, Amian S2 Love, Liz Gaspari, Cindy Vol, Alex Bleeping Jones, Terry, Leanne Marshall, and Moonbird.
You guys, thank you, thank you, thank you. An agape hug.
Linda, here's another interesting question, and it was asked last week in the chat, and it's also asked again by Tom the Man TV. Does Linda watch science fiction movies or even have time to? And from last week's chat, the question was, does Linda have a favorite science fiction film?
What came into my head exactly was the scene in Them, going all the way back probably to, what, the 1950s? I was born in January of 1942. And I know that I was old enough to be in the movie theater, and I know that my mom and dad were there, and that I am terrified of a scene on the screen in black and white of big ants that are, I was in grade school, and that the, these big ants are from someplace else in the universe. And what I don't remember is anything about the ending, but I remember these ants. Now, why am I bringing that up beyond the fact that that is exactly what just came into my mind as you asked the question? Jump up to the last 4 to 5 years, and going back probably 5 to 6, because it's in my Earth Files where I first did the reports, was after learning that Ronald Reagan was given a briefing at Camp David in March 6 to 8, 1981, by the CIA, NSA, DIA at Camp David. And what was the subject? 5 or 6 different extraterrestrial groups from different solar systems. And one of them was considered a enemy, a violence, a huge threat. And what were they? The trinoloids that are insects. And I thought about, I remember when I was working on that, those particular projects 5 or 6 years ago, having to do with the Reagan briefing, that the same scene came into my mind about these big ants in the movie Them as a big threat on the Earth. And it has occurred to me that there actually may be themes like that, that you, the, what you remember being traumatized by or thrilled by when you're 5 or 6 or 7 years old, it may literally relate to other lives and other knowledge that you don't know then, but eventually, like in my world, it has become huge. And the question of insects that could be a threat to the world, in from little to something giant from another planet, seems to me to be part of the interstitial concerns of the planet that we are actually living on now. And where will the future end up in our relationship with different civilizations that are definitely in this galaxy and beyond? And for those of you who have been reading some of the fascinating, exciting physics, astrophysics work recently, the New York Times has been doing beautiful coverage. And that has to do with various instruments that they're looking at galactic numbers and how many galaxies and going back how far. And the idea that on this beautiful Earth, in this one solar system, in one Milky Way galaxy, when there are trillions of galaxies by all of the new astrophysical work. Land, this is an exciting cosmos. And we shouldn't stop being excited about learning about it, because there may or may not be something every once in a while that might be a threat. Humans are threats to each other under certain circumstances. And I pray every day that we would get past that to agape hugs. Go ahead, Ian.
Okay, Linda. We have Amy Lopez has put this question up several times this evening. She says, can you tell Linda everything started 100 million years ago with the Lyran War? You go from there, you know the truth, etc.
See, the problem... The problem yeah. I have with the books that have the different drawings and so forth, they may end up being 100% corroborated and true. The problem is, in all directions, until we finally are in a government of the United States and our allies, in which it is decided that it is a much greater responsibility for a government that is supposed to be of, by, and for the people to let us know everything there is to know about other life forms in this universe. It just seems like a fundamental right of consciousness in a conscious universe. Their argument is, always has been, the technology, the weapons, all of that, that has to come first. Linda, don't be naive. Weapons and military and all of that, that has to come first. We have to make sure that we've got the best, that we're working with on the best technology. We are collaborating with the non-humans who can help us the most. And then later on, I think it's the other way around. I think that we as a population that was genetically manipulated by other life forms into being has a fundamental right to know everything. And that in the knowing of everything, we as a species, 8 billion strong right now, without any more thermonuclear wars with those, who knows what would happen. But if we all suddenly were revolutionized into a consciousness on planet Earth that has been home to many other consciousnesses that are out in the universe, I'm convinced of that. I think the Anunnaki and many of the languages that we have in the Middle East and Mesopotamia relate to actual extraterrestrial presences. If we could be told everything that everybody knows about the working relationship between the consciousness of the universe and the consciousness of life forms, it truly might change the future of this planet to one that is in doubt, to one in which humanity can finally prevail because it finally is on a planet that is not drowning in lies and deception. If the universe is conscious and all it gets in frequency from a planet or a solar system are lies and deception, why would it strengthen that solar system? I don't have proof either. But on this day in April, with so many of you feeling that it's a somewhere deep in here feeling with the eclipse of the sun, it is like a raw connection to the consciousness and force of the universe. And that when you experience it, then you want it to continue. That's the part that we all should want to continue. And the idea that right now we're at this truly revolutionary moment, another decade that may end up not so cool, that we and our minds and our hearts and our souls could change the end point. I wish for all of you to concentrate on an end point that has all of the thought that dwells in the light trying to help us. That's my wish now. It has been my prayer for a long time. And that I love coming together with you guys on Wednesdays, and that I hope we can keep doing this for a very long time. Brad told me today that we have now, I think this is our 303rd or 304th live broadcast. And let's keep going. Maybe we can do another 300. I truly love you, fellow human beings. And I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this Earth Files podcast from the edges of science, environment, and real X-Files. Go to www.earthfiles.com to see more than 1,000 Earth Files reports with photographs, drawings, and documents. And visit Earth Files every day, every week, for new reports and new podcasts. That's www.earthfiles.com.